RadioInfluence.com. The future is now.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Welcome in, everybody, to this Thursday, April 18th edition of the Landry Football Podcast. We are a week out from the NFL draft. Lot to get to there. We want to talk a little bit. I want to focus a lot as kind of a theme today. The importance of leadership at the top, which means ownership groups in the NFL, and their importance of how it allows a football person to do their job effectively. And we're going to talk a little bit about, how it affects in college football and leadership there, but the differences between the two and how you got to navigate them a little bit differently. So, and we're going to talk about how that theme kind of runs through the process. We've got some things to get caught up in terms of questions and a little bit of what's happening with the draft coming up a week from now, the latest goings on, and continuing from the Tuesday conversation of how things are taking place, the calls that are taking place, and how that may play out a week from today. Want to remind you, though, as we are taking you through every draft room around the NFL, every NFL team at LandryFootball.com, you get detailed analysis and look of where they want to improve their roster, how things are looking, where there needs to be focus, maybe some targets about when and where you might be able to mesh need with value. And you combine that with our draft boards that we've got up, where we got the horizontal board, the positional boards, and it tells you where the strengths are, where the weaknesses are, where the values are, where you're going to overpay, so on and so forth. You can see the numbers and how the numbers match up to picks in the draft and where, again, there's value, where there's quality, where you can get help, because the draft is about building a football team. It's about finding players that make your team better, finding good players that really fit. You're building a team, not just collecting talent. It's not fantasy football. And we stress that all along, so we'll continue to do that. And you want to take advantage right now of joining LandryFootball.com today to get a look at those draft boards, to get a feel for what's going on, to get a better understanding of how things work. We're going to be providing a lot of details and information of taking you through NFL history, NFL draft history, and how it shaped decisions that have been made around draft time years and years that affect the future of teams. So it's always fun to go back this time of year and look at those things. And we've got that on the horizon for you, too, by the weekend and as we head into draft week next week. So you'll want to be involved in LandryFootball.com, and you can do that very simply today. You can get the best discount we have had, and it'll take you through entire year, all the way through next year at this time. So you get the season, you get the breakdowns that we're going to have post-draft, and I really dig down into the film on spring practice. So you want to be involved in that and join our family there. We'd love to have you. All right. Want to start with kind of a theme, but I'm going to take it in a little bit of a different direction. Start in college, where good friend Scott Woodard, I've known for years, worked with him along with Mark Emmert when they both were at LSU previously in procuring Nick Saban there, and really good relationship. Really happy for him and his family that he's coming back to LSU. It's probably the best news that LSU's had in a long time. I think people may be aware, I grew up in the shadows of Tiger Stadium myself and went to games as a kid with my family, my parents, and obviously playing football and, walk-on player and student assistant coach, graduate assistant coach, started my career there. So I went to school at LSU and grew up going to LSU games, went to school there, got my first job there in coaching, and then it's on to a career in pro football and doing a lot of work now in pro and college football. But all was really formulated with the passion that I grew up following LSU football, following college football around the country, following the NFL. But we all are from somewhere, and I happen to be from Baton Rouge, as is Scott, or I actually am from a small town between Baton Rouge and New Orleans called Donaldsonville. Scott Woodard is also grew up in the shadows of Tiger Stadium. He comes in, he replaces Joe Oliva. A quick note on that. I had a decent relationship with Joe Oliva, quite frankly. Spent some time with him, not a lot. I, full disclosure, have to tell you that the relationship soured a little bit. Based upon nothing personal, but from a business standpoint, after being involved for years in doing a lot of consulting work for a lot of college programs, a lot of NFL teams, coaching and scouting in, but as it relates to this, coaching searches, evaluating coaches, I've always had good relationship with the folks there. Burr Jarsbury is a good friend. He's the associate athletic director, deputy athletic director, second in command, and just a great guy, great friend, and was a player when I was a young coach there. And he's dedicated his life, adult life, to LSU and being a loyal administrator. And so when Scott Woodard was there at the beginning, the first time with Mark Emmert, actually even before they even got involved, recommending Nick Saban and wasn't hired at the time, and they hired Donato, and then Emmert comes in, and Scott Woodard's there. They end up hiring Saban, certainly having a fondness for that program, as I do for a lot of programs in trying to help. You have built good relationships with athletic directors, administrators that – most are not from a football background. Joe was a college quarterback at Lehigh. Certainly no background in coaching. Didn't know the landscape of coaching very well. Most athletic directors don't. And that's why, having relationships with football people is so important. It's one of the things that I've tried to do to try to at least assist in evaluating. And then obviously, as you do in any matchmaking situation, it has to be the people that are going to work together decide whether it's a match. But with Joe Oliva, as he is out as the athletic director at LSU, the one thing that's really pivotal in today's college athletics is you've got to be a good communicator. You've got to do a good job. I think that being an athletic director, there are a number of things that are involved, but there are two things that are most important. One, you got to hire good coaches. Two, you got to raise funds. If you hire good coaches and you win, makes raising money a lot easier. In order to raise money, you've got to be personal. You got to be out there. You got to be accessible. You can't just sit behind the desk and close the door and be closed off to everyone, and where you're standoffish. It's a relationship that it doesn't work in the modern day world. There are things you have to do as an athletic director administratively. You got to administrate a lot of sports, departments, marketing and ticketing and concessions, and there are a lot of things. Certainly facilities and making good decisions. All those things are really important, but you can have people to help you with that. I thought Joe Oliva did a really good job with organizing some of the impetus for facilities. I thanked him personally for the job that he did, and just little things like getting the windows on the stadium, on North Stadium Drive, to look better, and because they were just dilapidated. LSU's back when the Huey Long days, for people who don't know, when he was the governor, they got, when they expanded the stadium, they got state funding because in the stadium, they made dorms in the stadium. Yes, there were college dorms in the stadiums. In fact, when I went to college there, they were still using the dorms in the stadium. I didn't live in the dorm stadium dorms, but that's where a lot of students did. Well, it was done that way because it was a way to get funding because they could UP Long could get state funding to basically expand the football stadium, but by putting dorms in the concourse area on the outside of it, it allowed them to get the funds to be able to do that. And so that's why they had maybe the unusual circumstance of having stadium dorms in the stadium. Well, they don't have dorms. The dorms are not used anymore in the stadium. They're used for other things. But the windows on them, just some of them were busted out. It looked awful as an eyesore. And it's one of the things that Joe Oliva said when he got in. I want to correct that. I want to, you know, that looks awful. And he did a good job of getting a plan together and get people in line to do that. And it's great. Little things like that. There are many of other little things. I think behind the scenes, he did some things that were pretty well. Joe Oliva, I think, is a value person to do certain things in athletic administration. He is not someone that has been successful as an athletic director. He is someone that is more of a behind-the-scenes guy that really struggled and, dare I say, failed as a out-front athletic director. He couldn't negotiate deals. He couldn't raise money. He couldn't close deals. He was awful in coaching searches. And just all in all, he didn't have a very good personality. Even within the athletic department, people that worked for him, you know, assistant ADs and all different departments, you know, he was cold, didn't recognize him, never said thank you. You know, people would lose a family member or people sick, never checked on him, never really had a personable touch to him. Different guy from New York, didn't really understand how maybe the people of Louisiana worked. This was a Dr. John Lombardi pushed through hiring Joe Oliva when no one else really wanted him. When Joe Oliva was hired, the board did not want him. They wanted to go in a different direction. It was Dr. John Lombardi, the president of the LSU systems, that pushed Joe Oliva through. In fact, if you remember, you've heard about Joe Oliva was the athletic director at Duke, was one of the folks that were involved and making some tough, unfortunate decisions with the Duke lacrosse team. The LSU board never got the chance to even ask Joe Oliva about that because it was ramrodded through that they put that Dr. John Lombardi put it in. And, you know, how did it get approved? Well, you know, the politics at it happens, and it did. And there we go, and we're off and running with Joe Oliva. And again, while there were some good things, gosh, three coaching hires. The best coaching hire he ever made is Will Wade. And that has blown up to some degree, and we don't know where that's going to end. The other coaching hires have been a mess. The handling of Les Miles was a mess. As I mentioned, his relationship with his staff was not very good. The coaches on LSU's campus did not like Joe. Even the ones that he did good things, you know, he finally got a gymnastics center built, and that's great. But even they didn't really like him because he wasn't very personable. It's tough. For those of you not from Louisiana, it's a very warm, embracing community. And when you're standoffish, it just doesn't go well. You're in a leadership position. You got to be out front. And now you got to have good people behind the scenes doing the legwork, but you've got to be out front. Press the flesh. Be that guy. You ever see Joe Oliva, you know, get on TV and do interviews? You don't see that unless he's at a press conference announcing a coach. he's just not out in front. The SEC office did not like him, how he handled situations. Regardless of the degree of fault belonging with him and the Florida situation, how he handled it was poor. Basically, he created an embarrassing situation for the league. So, unfortunately, this is the result, and probably a long time coming, that Joe is no longer the athletic director. My concern and fear and my issue with Joe on a personal level was, as they began to look at situations, Joe only hired one coach, and that's current coach Ed Orgeron. Joe did not like Les Miles. Les Miles did not like Joe Oliva. And that turned negatively there again. Poorly handled. You can make a coaching change. You can upgrade your coaching position. It is a produce or you're out world at the highest level. You can debate the value and the quality of Les Miles' tenure. I mean, it was good. I think anybody that says otherwise is wrong. But you can say that it underachieved and there were greater opportunities to succeed more. It didn't work out that way. But how it was handled. How the whole situation was bungled, leaving Les Miles in the wind, basically firing him without announcing it, leaking it out to the press, and then thinking you had Jimbo Fisher, failing to close the deal, along with your president, Chancellor F. King Alexander, who is still there, the failure to close that deal, then having to backtrack and keep Les Miles and try to spin it as we said we weren't going to make a decision to the end of the year. Now we are. That was the plan. Everyone saw through that. Again, a someone with zero PR presence, and that has been a problem too. LSU has worked hard to try to improve their public relations area. Robert Munson was now heading things up, and certainly there's been a lot of problems, and the sports information director at LSU is certainly lacking in terms of power and understanding, and getting through to Joe Oliva was probably like hitting your head against the wall anyway. So there's a fundamental need for figuring things out better. So they go in and the next year, and Les Miles is back, and of course he's fired, and then of course they're going to put Ed Orgeron as an interim, and then they're going to move on, and they're going to hire Jimbo Fisher again, and they strike out again. Then they're going to hire Tom Herman. Tom Herman uses them for leverage. They don't figure it out. Even though they were told, I can tell you, I was one of them that told them, Tom was headed to Texas all along, and that just didn't work out. Well, how did he handle it? In a snit. Because he wanted to announce the head coach at LSU before Texas as if he's going to fool anybody. And like, yeah, we decided we're going to hire Ed Orgeron and not hire you, Tom Herman. Well, everybody knew that you were turned down by Herman. He did that. And that came off poorly. And it came off poorly because it was poorly handled all around. From the ending of Les Miles to how Ed Orgeron was hired. Ed Orgeron would have waited. Now, enter what I want to mention. Having done some work for them, having lined up what I thought was two great coaching candidates that are successful coaches in college football today that were absolutely interested in the job, why not interview those guys and see? Ed Orgeron was going to be there waiting for you a week later. If you wanted to offer the job to him then. It wasn't like anybody else was jumping to hire Ed Orgeron. Ed was going to be there. So why not do your due diligence? But there again, as Joe Oliva said, I am the search. That's all that matters. And again, that's fine if you know what you're doing. Joe was not personable enough to get the right help that he needed and was stubborn. Now so was Les Miles. I tried to help Les Miles and some of his assistant moves. He was stubborn in how he did it. Well, it cost him his job, and now it's cost Joe Oliva his job. I do think and hope that people respect and appreciate the good things that Joe Oliva did do, but it is past time that they improve things at LSU, and that leads to Scott Woodard. Look, there is no guarantee of anything. I don't know that I agree that there's anything such as a slam dunk hire, but in terms of a fit, as an athletic director, couldn't find anybody better. The timing couldn't be better, or let me correct that. The timing could have been better, actually, but the person is not any better than Scott Woodard. Those of us that know Scott, those of us that work with Scott, as I mentioned on the coaching search when they hired LSU, that was Mark Emmert and Scott Woodard getting that done. Joe Dean with the athletic director, but he just facilitated what Mark Emmert wanted to do. And working with Scott, I know how he can work a room. Listen, if you're going to be involved in the LSU athletic department, you need to be able to work a room. You need to be a diplomat. You need to get everybody on the same page. You need to get everybody thinking that they're engaged, they're involved. Mark Emmert, while he is heavily criticized, and perhaps rightly so, as the head of the NCAA, was very good at working a room, and one of the guys that he taught that was his right-hand man was Scott Woodard. He actually hired and trained Scott Woodard to be a lobbyist in the state legislature of Louisiana for the LSU Athletic Department and in some other university faction. So it's not just, you know, getting certain things built, infrastructure, but even on the campus, the E.J. Orso Business School, the engineering school, all the improvements that they made on the campus really was due to what Mark Emmert did, and Mark was outstanding. I thought Scott Woodard did a really good job of being able to handle that. Key boosters didn't like Joe Oliva. Again, didn't have a good relationship. Well, everybody seems to like Woodard. Now, Woody, as he's called, is somebody that grew up in Baton Rouge, went to Catholic high school, went to LSU, graduated from LSU, and again, worked at LSU and cultivated a lot of relationships in the political realm, a lot of relationships, and those are the people that get put appointed by the governor to be on the LSU Board of Supervisors. That's what it's called, not the trustees. It's called in other schools, it's the Board of Supervisors. You've got to be able to work that in order to the Board of Supervisors cannot fire an athletic director. The Board of Supervisors, though, can put pressure to get things done and oversee. That is basically, it is like Congress is for our government. This is what it is. It's a Congress for the university. And most all universities, state universities, have this. Scott is as qualified as anybody I could even possibly think of in terms of dealing with the political realm. Now, Scott is not a football guy. He's not a sports guy. He's a guy that's a great organizer. He's a diplomat. He gets things done. He raises money. And he's a consensus builder. He goes with Mark Emmert to Washington, and they hire Chris Peterson. Now, let me say this. I hear people say this. Want to be factual. Well, he hired Chris Peterson. Chris Peterson turned down everybody, but they got him to go to Washington. Let me explain. Chris Peterson, there's only two schools that Chris Peterson was ever interested in leaving Boise State for. That was Oregon and Washington. He's a Northwest guy. That's his home. Not interested in USC and living in L.A., not interested in Miami, not interested in Michigan or Ohio State or LSU or Alabama or any other place. Interested in the Northwest. So they had a built-in. And knowing Chris, that was a big part of it, and Scott and I discussed it when he went to Washington to be the athletic director for Mark Emmert. Mark Emmert's from Washington. His parents live there, and so he took the president job at University of Washington and brought with him Scott Woodard to be his athletic director, because essentially Scott Woodard was above the athletic director, and the liaison was the right-hand man to Mark Emmert, and the chancellor representative to the athletic department when Nick Saban was there. When Nick Saban was at LSU, his phone calls went to Mark and Scott. They did everything. Not Joe Dean, not Skip Burtman, who replaced Joe Dean. It was essentially Scott Woodard overseeing all of that. So he goes to Washington, does a good job, and hires Steve Sarkisian, who, listen, did a good job as well. Goes to A&M, gets closer to home. And everybody has repeated this and knows that he was able to, with A&M's money and the backing of the president, which, again, LSU didn't have, and financial issues, and the president saying no to not being able to get the money for Jimbo Fisher and all that. They made an offer to Jimbo Fisher. It wasn't enough. They weren't able to get a deal done. That is not all 100% on Joe Oliva. It was some should be put at the feet of F. King Alexander. But A&M, no such problem with their money. They go get a deal done with Jimbo Fisher. And there was no, hey, it was known it was going to be Jimbo Fisher, but yet it was kind of quiet. There was no talk. It was Kevin Sumlin was, you know, knew he had to go and win and get it done, couldn't get it done. Boom. It wasn't a search. It was a clear focus, know who we got, and you get it done guy. That is good organization, good preparation behind the scenes, good consensus building behind the scenes. You got a plan. You have a plan before you have to execute the plan. So when it's time to execute the plan, it's done. You make one decision on Monday, and Tuesday you got the next decision done. That's how you do it. And he did that very well. Did the same thing just recently with Buzz Williams coming in as the basketball coach. Some people thought Billy Kennedy should have stayed. Whether you think he should have or not, Scott decided to go in a different direction. He had his guy, Buzz, really good coach, Buzz, a former A&M assistant. That was, you could read the tea leaves that was happening, and boom, that was clean. It was no ambiguity. Boom. That's the type, that's the complete 180 from what LSU's been able to do in the past. Now, is that all on, you know, hey, Scott Woodard's going to wave his magic wand? No. Scott, I think, would have handled the situations better in this situation than Joe Oliva. But you also need to have, I think, a hard look at the upper university hierarchy with regard to F. King Alexander, because that is still going to be Scott Woodard's boss. Now, Scott, again, will be able to get F. King Alexander to understand a little bit more about maybe what they should or shouldn't do. And I think he'll be given more leeway because I think he'll kind of earn that. He'll has a way of getting earning people's trust. But again, it's not all 100% on Oliva. It's some on F. King Alexander. And I think they're going to have to look hard at where the leadership is with the LSU University structure, because that's where I want to go with this. You're only as good as your upper tier structure and your commitment at the university level. If you're president of your university, your chancellor, if they're not on board with making high athletics a big priority, you're going to be in trouble. Listen, they're responsible for running the university. They need to be responsible for overseeing everything. They are mostly needed to run a university and the academic side of it. But they need to give leeway to somebody that can run the athletic department, that could raise funds for it and make that the front porch of your university, which is going to open up the coffers of the rest of your university to a large degree. And you have to have the right leadership that understands that. And if you don't, it will minimize the effectiveness of an athletic director, and it will minimize the effectiveness of your coaches of your sports. Just like poor ownership in the NFL will negatively or positively affect your ability to be successful at that level. Scott Woodard, it was never an issue of whether he'd come back to LSU. It was an issue of whether he would get offered the job. While it may seem in some people's eyes that it was a given, nothing's a given, because with politics, there's always somebody that may want to block this or that because they've got their own personal agenda. There again, the strength was that Scott Woodard was someone that was kind of universally approved, liked. Well, some people like Scott more than others, but everybody likes it. And even the ones that are not the biggest fans maybe still think he's good. And that's a good sign. Everyone can debate and talk about how he's one of the great athletic directors. That is chapters yet to be written. Scott's a good friend. and he would know and understand when I say this. His ability as an athletic director, he's still pretty young in that realm. They've guys with much more experience. What I can say with certainty is, without question, he is the ideal fit at LSU, and I think that is important. I think you can get away with a football coach that maybe is not from the area, but the athletic director, if he doesn't understand your culture, you're going to have a problem. No one understands the Louisiana and the LSU culture that is qualified to be an athletic director better than Scott Woodard. He's wanted this job for a long time. I tell stories all the time. He lives about 4 minutes from the airport, 5 minutes from the airport, and he comes to Baton Rouge two times a month. He's got a house on LSU Avenue. He has a home. He's got a camp as well. His parents live here. His brother's a neighbor of mine. His family's here. The box at the Texas A&M on weekends, his athletic director box, has more LSU people in it than A&M people. He's a Louisiana guy. Scott does have a heart condition. We share that. We also share same cardiologist. He'd come down because he's had a problem for a long time. He comes down for his checkups. He was at LSU spring game last Saturday. He's been at LSU spring game, I think, the last 4 or 5 years. When he was the athletic director at A&M, when he was athletic director at Washington, he was at home games. He was always in Baton Rouge. That was his home. That's where he always came to visit. Now, he doesn't have to come home to Baton Rouge to visit. He comes home to Baton Rouge to live. His family is really excited. He's really excited. I'm happy for him. Most importantly, happy for LSU. And what does it mean for the future? Time will tell. But I think that they're in better position to make decisions, tough decisions, than they were before. To piggyback off with that, to jump back onto the NFL draft scene and talking about ownership structure and how that creates stability or instability, and the key for that being the growth and development of your team and your program, it's where I want to spend a couple of minutes on. In order for a football person, and I think it's, you know, for my counterparts in basketball and other sports, I think the same rings true there, but from what I can relate to in my work, working for an owner that will allow you to do your job and hold you accountable, ask questions and learn from you, but allow you to do your job in having the stability and patience and strong enough to stand up to those that want change for the sake of change, those are the ones that have success. Now, in order to have stability, you got to hire correctly first. And that goes into what we were just talking about, whether you're an athletic director, chancellor, you know, owner, you know, you've got to make good hires, and you've got to make substantive hires, not when the press conference hire, not, you know, let's do what's popular. Let's get the right fit, the right guy. And with that, you put a structure in place and you build it and you're patient with it. And you see that you're on track, you try to massage that and get that better and grow it. But you've got to have the vision, then have the gumption to create the stability for growth and development. And you have to have that support, because owners own. And universities are not owned, but they are run in a political realm. And quite frankly, it is more complex to deal with at the college level, because, you know, it could be a key booster, it could be a couple of key board members or, you know, trustee members that have a little bit more influence, and all of a sudden it kind of changes things. It's very, very political. Whereas in the NFL, it's pretty more straightforward. The owner will make the decision, or, you know, somebody in his family, or, you know, it, where it's less, you have to sort through much less clutter to figure out who's calling the shots. But in either case, you got to have the structure. So what does it mean? Well, in college, it means having somebody that can navigate the waters with sharks and maybe be the dolphin in the water that can create calm. Create serenity. Create a sense of, hey, it's not about me, it's about us. To create a sense of ownership among the people that are involved. They want to give more and contribute more and help more when they feel a part of it, when they feel engaged. And you got to do it at the college level. At the pro level, you have to have, from an ownership standpoint, while it doesn't have the political element that's the same, you have to have a structure and a willingness to hire good people and let them do their job and get them to work together and kind of manage egos and make sure that everyone understands that they have a role. This is your role. Outline everybody's role. Make it clear. And then the success that's had by all of us as a unit will lead to individual success and growth. It seems obvious, and it seems kind of second nature, but it is not discussed enough. It's not appreciated enough for what it leads to in terms of success in an organization. So as it relates to, like, right now for the draft, well, the structure of what you allow in terms of your resources to get the work done, that's already been done. But right now, good ownership is supporting their personnel staff, supporting their coaches. You need me, you need anything, let us know. Be there for you. That's what you want. Not jumping in there and saying, I like this, I heard that, whatever. I may like this guy, but you guys do what you think is best. You're the one that's done the work. And trust that they're going to do their job. The organizations that are aligned that way have a better, clearer understanding of what to do. There's less meddlesome. There's less panic. There's less reactionary moves. And there's more sound decisions based upon good evaluations. I mean, it's like anything else. If you plant something, you've got to allow it to grow and cultivate. So often today, we want to plant something and have it bear fruit the next day. It just doesn't work that way. We all know that. But yet, that's exactly what insufficient organizations tend to do. They tend to be chaotic. They tend to be reactionary. So as we're getting into this ending of the last week prior to draft week, it is a lot about, people have asked me, do you meet with ownership? Well, meet with ownership a little bit prior to the draft. Make them aware of what's going on. They may want to know who you're going to draft. Of course, you don't have that answer, definitely, unless you're picking high. But you can share with them, this is who we like. This is who we think's best value. Here's what we think's going to happen. They'll have questions about what's going on in the league. What do you think's going to happen? What resources do we need? If we need to redo a contract last minute and give some outlay of cash to restructure a deal, make sure that's, is okay and understood that it's not going to happen in the normal time frame that it happens at the rest of the year. Draft time, something may happen on draft day when you're on the clock, and it may mean you have to structure a deal, agree in principle on redoing a player, maybe trade a player. A lot of things may happen, so you need to make sure that he's aware of that and that you have the freedom to do that and not have to sit there and worry about contacting him on draft day. As we get into next week, and we'll talk about what goes on draft week, because it will be draft week, I'm going to talk a little bit more about draft scenarios right now. What are the Cardinals doing? Why are they doing it? They're saying that they haven't decided who they want to pick. Well, they know who they're going to pick if they stay at number one. What they don't know with 100% certainty is that someone may call with an offer. They want to consider it. You keep all your options open. You're San Francisco. You got your plan based upon what you think Arizona might do, but you are prepared. You know that only one player can go before you. So you're prepared to go in a couple of directions, depending on who's there. The Jets, three, same thing. They know who they want. You're at this point, you have your board set. So your board tells you who you really want, but then you start to position yourself, maneuver yourself, and get heavily involved in draft management, which is trying to anticipate the options that will be before you when you pick. And so we're going to get into that a little bit more. And, of course, in great detail, we have that available on LandryFootball.com in our Inside the Draft Room segment for each and every team. So check that out. Got a couple of questions I want to get to before we call it a day here. Jacob, a good listener and sends questions. He was at the Tulane spring practice this past week. Appreciate him sending some notes of what he saw there, and we'll get into more spring practice film breakdowns as we get the draft behind me. Talked about Justin McMillan. Justin was the LSU quarterback transfer. Talked about an unquestioned starter. There's no doubt about that. I think he proved that last year. He talked a little bit about how that is playing. They're talking. He mentioned that they're installing more of a horizontal passing game, bootlegs and crossing patterns. Well, that's kind of a fundamental part of what they like to do or what they want to do. And the reason why you do that is because it's a little bit easier to block, is easier to get defenses out of position. He mentioned that he had a hard time running against the first defensive unit. Quarterbacks are more of a movement-type guys, no question about that. So, good job, and good notes from the game. And I'm glad and hope you enjoyed it at Tulane. Jacob's a big Tulane and Saints fan. Kevin asks, is it fair to say that of all the drafted players with an evaluation score of 5.5 or below, linebackers have the best overall probability of becoming purple grady players, which are quality starters? No, that's not the case. All you're seeing is that there seems to be a little bit larger number of linebackers with 5.5, below 5.5 grades, but that's where they are in terms of grade. That there's not a great percentage of them that are going to be in the purple grade category in the next level. It's not that at all. It doesn't mean that there's more likely to be. Are there more numbers that are going to be maybe later picks and can be backups, situational players, maybe, you know, orange grade players in the league? That is more likely than the probabilities of more purple graded players. Don't confuse the fact that guys are graded below that area, which are graded and put it in a color category in the college draft, and how that necessarily translates to the pro game. It's a little bit different. Guys that are in the below 5.5 area are, by and large, rarely going to be quality players at any position. With respect to linebackers, can you compare and contrast the philosophies of Bill Belichick and Dick LeBeau? Well, Bill Belichick is a little bit more, as a rule, he likes guys that are big and physical and smart, that he can play in multiple spots. So Bill's guys are a little bit bigger. He'll sacrifice a tad of speed for versatility, positioning, because he'll put them in great position. They're smart. They can do things differently, schematically, week to week. But he wants guys that are really strong at the point of attack. Dick LeBeau is a little bit more aggressive a little bit more of an attacking style. And they had to be really effective blitzers because they ran a lot of zone blitz looks where they dropped defensive linemen, they'd bring the linebackers. Can you explain why London Fletcher had such a prolonged career? Because he was very, very bright. I mean, very smart, good quickness, good versatility, really good instincts, and really good toughness. Why was he undrafted? Because he was undersized and overlooked. His physical skills did not match up ideally what you want, and he overcame it. His quickness, I think, was underrated by some people. His instincts was definitely underrated. he overcame his physical size. He was not a fit in every system. But this is a case of a guy that really fit. You know, he wouldn't have been, for example, a really good fit for Bill Belichick. Bill would not have utilized him quite the same way. But he had a really good career, did London, because he fit in a system as an undersized player that had range, that had instincts, could feel hard, could cover. He had great versatility, great instincts, great toughness. But he overcame some physical limitations, and that's why he wasn't drafted, but why he was able to play so effectively. And teams really understood the way they used him, how he made plays, and how he could fit their system. That's why he had a nice career. All right, folks, hope you have a great week. Again, we will get heavy into the draft next week. Again, continue on that pace and take you in the draft rooms, give you a feel for what's going on. Remember, keep it at LandryFootball.com for all the latest, taking you inside the draft room, what's going on around the league. That's where you want to be. If you haven't joined yet, do so today. You get the best discount. You get the draft process. You get the process that takes you through the season, getting ready for the season, through the season, all the way through next year at this time. And check out the War Room newsletter. We appreciate you joining us. Join us again on Tuesday for another edition of the Landry Football Podcast on LandryFootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a Sitting Ringside with David Penzer quick fix on Radio Influence.
Former WCW and current WWE referee extraordinaire, Charles Robinson.
So you did Ric Flair's retirement match at WrestleMania 24.
Retired him, yeah. Shawn Michaels didn't retire him. If the count wouldn't have happened, he wouldn't be retired. So I retired Ric Flair. Retired Shawn Michaels. I retired a couple of the two greatest.
When did you
say that in jest?
Of course you do. When did you find out that you would be the referee for that match that Flair requested? Did you request it, or how did that come about?
It just happened. I don't know if Rick requested it. I certainly didn't request it because I don't like to request matches. I like to just deal with what I'm given and do the best that I can. But I was lucky enough to get it done. But I think we knew like a month out that I was going to referee that match.
A very emotional finish. One of the most emotional and memorable finishes in a match that I could think of in all the years I've been watching wrestling, where he said, "I love you, I'm sorry," right before he gave him the super kick and pinned him. As a referee and a Ric Flair fan, you know, we talked about how in the beginning, early stages, you marked out at stuff and you kind of, now it's just part of the business. Was there any emotion in that ring that you felt at the moment, or are you just there to do your job and then soak it up later?
Going into the go-home sequence, you know, with the kick and all, I think all of us were already crying. So there was a lot of emotion in the ring. Who wasn't emotional that night? We were all crying. I rolled right out of the ring because I was sobbing.
I always say my favorite WCW moment was when Ric Flair came back in the Horseman in Greenville, North Carolina, when Arn put him back together. But to me, that moment was as memorable watching on TV as the Horseman moment was live. And just there's certain moments that you'll never forget. And that, you know, I love you, I'm sorry. It's just unbelievable. It still gives me goosebumps now that we're talking about it.
Sitting Ringside with David Penzer can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.